tonight on Canton Confidential, Conflicting Memories.
So it's fair to say that your memory is a little bit faulty.
And poked holes in protocol.
It was an oversight.
An oversight.
Yes, sir.
The Karen Reed defense team striking quickly as the prosecution looks to lay out a cold-blooded crime.
We found no breathing, no pulse. I hit him.
Now at 7, we are taking you into the courtroom to give you context and coverage like no other station. Canton Confidential, a Karen Reed murder trial, starts right now.
Day 2 of testimony in the high-profile Karen Reed murder trial could prove consequential. Good evening. I'm Glenn Jones.
I'm JC Monahan. Now, Reed, of course, accused of hitting her Boston police officer boyfriend, John O'Keefe, with her SUV and then leaving him to die in a blizzard. On the stand today were Canton first responders. The defense cross-examined Officer Stephen Sarif. He was the first officer on the scene the morning O'Keefe was found in the snow. We also heard from a second officer, as well as a paramedic who gave first aid and a fire lieutenant.
All right, to help break down today's key moments, let's send things out to NBC 10's Kirsten Glavin. She is live outside the courthouse in Denham. Kirsten.
Well, it was during today's cross-examination that we really heard the defense highlight some of the discrepancies between what was documented and what first responders said they remembered. Karen Reed's attorneys coming out swinging, piercing holes through the state story of what happened the moments after Boston police officer John O'Keefe was found dead.
And see if you see that same person walking toward the house. Stop.
Yes, I saw the shadow, yes.
The first Canton police officer on scene, Stephen Sarif, shown this video of that snowy morning in 2022, then scrutinized.
There was a person walking from the area where a body was found in the lawn of a house, walking into the house to make contact with other individuals, correct?
It appeared that way, yes, sir.
Does that seem appropriate to you?
No.
Sarif also changing his story from what was documented in his initial written report.
Yes, it was an oversight.
An oversight?
Yes, sir.
That a woman whom you made contact with, standing over the body of a fallen police officer, said to you, "This is my fault." Just missed that one. Yes,
I missed it. Yeah, I didn't write it down.
Other witnesses, including a Canton police patrolman.
She was screaming, "Is that my boyfriend? Is he dead?"
And two members of the fire department who described seeing Reed hysterical, trying to perform life-saving measures on O'Keefe's body.
I hit him.
This paramedic questioned about what exactly he heard.
That story has changed to you posed a question and she answered your question, correct?
Correct.
So which is it?
Leaving court on Tuesday, we asked Karen Reed about that alleged confession. Karen, did you ever say, I hit him?
I did not.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
Reed's father acknowledging the strain on their family.
It's hell. I never thought we'd be in this position.
Adding he's confident in Reed's attorneys.
Knowing what we know and the truth before us, but we'll play it out.
Now, looking ahead, there is no court tomorrow, but this trial is set to resume for a half day on Thursday.
Kirsten Glavin, thank you. We want to bring in now our first guest, Todd McGee, a retired Massachusetts State Police trooper who specializes in security analysis.
And we want to get into this testimony today. Before this trial began, you told me you had some concerns about the policing in this case. It seems like on cross, that's exactly what the defense went after with Officer Stephen Sarif on the stand. Everybody wants to know, us included, why he wouldn't go inside that home on the night that the body was discovered. Of course, John O'Keefe's body found outside the home of Brian Albert, another Boston police officer, and yet the investigators never went inside. Let's listen to that moment of the testimony.
Do you think that would have been appropriate protocol when dealing with a body laying on a lawn that is partially unclothed to look inside the house of the lawn?
No.
You didn't think that would have been an appropriate protocol?
No.
For you or anybody else?
No.
Okay, we have to admit, we're not law enforcement, but it does seem reasonable that you would go inside the home of the place where this happened.
As a law enforcement investigator, the first thing you're looking for are facts. Facts lead to evidence. Evidence can be gleaned from eyewitness accounts, from the Ring doorbells, anything that can help you stitch this mystery back together again. And the fact that the investigation wasn't thorough provides a big wrinkle in the prosecution's case.
But what do you, when he says, no, that I wouldn't expect anybody to
not
have done that.
Not even knock on the door.
Right. Does that ring true for you?
It does not. It does not ring true, because if I can find one person to help me spell out this story, to help bring some clarification, anything. Was there another vehicle close by? Was there another eyewitness as a neighbor that I might be able to go and speak to? The first 24 to 48 hours is significant in any investigation to get the closest and key witnesses interviewed.
Let's talk about some of the discrepancies that the defense was basically able to poke holes in some of that testimony. First of all, the incident report, they said the time of the arrival for those first officers, those were wrong. They mentioned that the defense highlighted what was not in the report as well when police arrived, which was what Karen Reed was or was not saying. Matter of fact, we have a little clip from that. You want to just play that?
So in April of 2022, for the first time, you attributed the phrase, "This is my fault. I can't believe this happened," to my client, correct?
That's correct.
But nowhere in your official report did you say that.
Correct? That's correct.
And nowhere in your interview with Trooper Proctor the next day did you say that.
That's correct.
You think that was a pretty important omission on your part?
It was an oversight.
An oversight?
Yes, sir.
That a woman whom you made contact with, standing over the body of a fallen police officer, said to you, "This is my fault." Just missed that one. Yes?
Yes, yes, I missed it. Yeah, I didn't write it down.
You know what was written down? The wrong address of where they showed up. That was another thing that they pointed out. I'm not even going to tee this up. Just
so missteps happen, which is the reason why you go into the residence, which is why you knock on doors. This is why you find other people that can help tell the story or help lead you to the next witness to help bring some clarity to this. As far as the time goes, the time reporting and documenting starts once you get the call, let alone on scene. When were you assigned the case? Who's on duty that day to receive the case, to respond to the at the time, they didn't know if it was a murder or if it was just a body in the snow.
Right.
They didn't know it was a Boston police officer initially. So all that information had to be put together. It had to be researched and investigated.
But how do the words, "I hit him," not get into an initial report? I think, wasn't that the point? Like, how do you forget that?
Yep. And that's the mystery here. We don't know what was going on in that investigator's day. Was he overwhelmed with additional cases? Was he coming from another scene? Maybe he was overworked. Could be a lot of factors for that. So again, mistakes happen, oversights happen, but that's why you have the additional pieces of information to help fill in the gaps.
We're still early in this trial. At some point, we're going to see state police on the stand, and they're going to face some challenging questions. We know that based on what we heard in the opening statements from the defense. Should those officers be challenged, particularly Michael Proctor? And if they are challenged, is it appropriate to do so?
It is appropriate. You're talking about someone's life that's on the line. This is a criminal trial. Karen Reed has been alleged to have killed a Boston police officer, her boyfriend, but nonetheless, Boston police officer. So a high-profile case, is the defense is going to peel back every layer they possibly can. In order, all they need, the burden of proof is on prosecution.
Right.
So they only need one juror, that could declare either a mistrial or an acquittal. A mistrial, we'll have to go through all this again. But if it's enough to create that doubt, that defense has done their job.
Yeah.
Todd McGee, I imagine we're going to see you a lot over the next 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah, we appreciate your insight.
Thank you.
When we come back, we bring in a criminal defense lawyer to help us understand why the prosecution and defense seem to be operating at two different speeds. For now, here's a live look at the Norfolk County Superior Courthouse in Denham. Canton Confidential continues after this. Welcome back to NBC10's Canton Confidential. We're only 2 days into testimony, but already we're seeing very different strategies from the two teams in the courtroom.
Well, the prosecution appears to be slowly laying out their case, putting an emphasis, let's start with the weather, when first responders showed up at the house. While the defense, really, they seem to be going straight to the details of the case. Police logs, what exactly was said by Karen Reed to police that morning. So we want to break down these strategies. Joining us now is Morgita Derisier, an attorney with Bay State Law Group who specializes in criminal defense. Thank you so much for being with us. We need this perspective.
Morgita, we're going to get to you in a moment, but we want you to help us figure out both sides and how effective they've been so far in this case. Let's take the second officer's testimony today. The prosecution asked him if anyone at the home or in the neighborhood came out when first responders were on the scene that morning. Let's listen.
Now, as far as the residence in 34 Fairview Road, did you see anybody go in or come out of that residence during the time that you were on scene?
No.
And as far as any of the other residences on the entire rest of the street, did you see any of the neighbors or anybody else come outside at any point in time?
I did not.
Okay, it was early Saturday. It was dark. The prosecution seemed to effectively explain why perhaps the Elberts did not come outside. On the flip side, watch what the defense does on the cross of that same officer.
One question, if I might.
Okay.
Recross.
Sure.
And I don't mean to be a wise guy, sir, but did any of the other neighbors on the entire street have the body of a dead police officer on their front lawn?
Objection.
All right, so that's sustained. All right. You are.
Morgita, talk to us about the strategy. I mean, from outsiders, it just seems very slow on the prosecution side. And on the defense side, they really seem to be just really honing in on what I would think the jurors would think are important facts.
Absolutely. I really like what the defense is doing. They're coming in very strong. They're asking all the important questions. But that's their job, right? They're supposed to be creating this reasonable doubt, and they're doing exactly that. I think I agree. The prosecution is coming out a little slow. You know, they're very stagnant with their presentation of the case. And I wonder if that's part of their strategy, but really only time will tell.
Right.
In that last bit of testimony, we heard the prosecution object, but it was only after the witness already responded to the question. How does the jury evaluate that? Because I know they can't unhear it.
Right. You know, that's the interesting thing about trying cases, right? You're supposed to protect what the jury hears, but sometimes they already hear it and they can't unhear it. So as a defense attorney or as the prosecutor, you have to anticipate what your witness is going to say and make the objections before that testimony comes out, if you can. But sometimes you can't.
Let's talk about the confidence that we saw earlier. We saw the defense attorney, Ellen Jackson, walking out of court and said there aren't any witnesses from the prosecution side that makes him nervous. It's only day two of what's projected to be a 6 to 8 week trial. Is that fair to be that confident this early on?
I mean, this is a murder case, right? You have to be very confident. You have to protect your client's innocence and their image as well. It's only been 2 days, but they've been doing a great job. I think there's a lot more evidence to come out, but they've been doing a really good job. So that confidence is warranted.
You know what's interesting for laymen like me watching this case? I know that the prosecution is putting on its case right now, but so far, I feel like I'm watching the defense put on its case. How can that be?
Yeah, you know, you have to be really careful about that as a defense attorney, because the burden of proof is on the prosecution side. And at some point, you have to think about strategy and how much information do you poke at, how much information do you put on as a defense attorney. But when the prosecution is, you know, kind of given information that is easily poked at, you got to take those advantages.
All right. It's really early, and I'm going to put you on the spot. But as a criminal defense attorney, would you put Karen Reed on the stand?
Way too early to decide. There's so many factors that go into whether you put someone on the stand or not. I'm sure they've talked about it behind closed doors, but it's way too early to decide that, even if I had the case.
You have to feel it in the moment, whether or not the jury needs to hear and see her.
Yeah, and you also have to see, you know, again, it's the prosecution's burden, right? So have they even met that burden yet, right? And, you know, that's something that you can't really ascertain until they're done.
We'll have you back in 3 weeks and ask the same question. Thank you very much.
No problem. When we come back, our trial analyst, Sue O'Connell, was in the courtroom, and we'll talk with her about it. There was this lighthearted moment, if you can imagine, in this situation that happened today, what it says about perhaps Karen Reed's attorney. We'll be right back. The Karen Reed murder trial is getting a lot of attention, not just around here, but around the country.
Only a few dozen people are allowed in the courtroom on any given day, and we're joined by one of them tonight, our very own courtroom insider, Sue O'Connell. It's good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Sue, you were in the courtroom when they were picking the jury pool.
Right.
But today, not only was today day two of testimony and you were in the courtroom, but it was also the first day where the defense was cross-examining any of the witnesses. Mm-hmm. So just, can you give us... give us the inside dish. Like, what was it like in there?
Well, it's very snug. I know it doesn't seem so snug when you're watching on TV or online because you're seeing just a shot, but I can count. I can almost touch everyone who's in the courtroom, and that kind of gives it a different feeling because you're all up on top of each other. And you can see that this has really happened with the jury now. This is, they come in with their books, their notebooks, they're paying attention, they're looking back and forth as the questions go back and forth. So the intensity is there in this intimate, like, little tiny snug room. So there's a lot going on, and you can really feel it.
Just to point that out, this is a different courtroom than when we started.
Yes. Right. So on that point, sight lines were very much an issue in the other courtroom, even though it was larger. This one is much smaller. I imagine sight lines are no longer an issue.
Not at all. I mean, I can tell what people have in their pockets and what, you know, if someone's ordering lunch. I mean, there's no phones allowed in there. But, I mean, yeah, there's no sight line problem. And I think it's also very interesting because that also means that the witnesses are very close to the jury and the families. You know, there aren't a lot of people allowed in. There's no room for them. So the supporters of Karen Reed, the family of O'Keefe and supporters there, are all very close together.
That intimacy, then, that would be effective on the jury one way or another. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're hearing John O'Keefe's family crying and literally could reach out and touch them, but at the same time, if you're testifying,
right,
and I could basically... sort of, that you feel that.
You do, and you also, when you're listening to the dash cam footage, it's really loud, and it's really, really, you know, touches you that this is happening. And it's a bit disturbing. I mean, you know, these cases, murder cases, are serious, and when you see this kind of evidence, if you're a human being, it's disturbing. But to be in that small room and have it be so loud, that's also hard.
Sue, let's pivot to one of the lighter moments during testimony today. A Canton paramedic was asked to describe the injuries he observed on John O'Keefe's body, and he spoke about scratches he saw on O'Keefe's arm. Let's listen.
But the word that you used was scratches.
Yes, there were like furrows down.
Say that again?
Furrows, if you will, for lack of a better term. Just,
I don't understand that word.
So if you remove something, like you create a furrow in the skin, is that?
Furrows.
Yes, there you go. Sorry. Excuse my accent.
No. I'm on your turf.
Fair enough.
It's my accent.
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is a serious business, right? This is John O'Keefe is dead. It's a tragedy. And so when you get this kind of one moment of levity around it, even though it's around a gruesome detail, and what, you know, defense attorney Alan Jackson did, which was kind of brilliant, is...
It was brilliant.
He apologized, I'm on your turf. Mm-hmm. You know, that definitely, I have no doubt, endeared him to the jury. And what's also funny is everybody in the courtroom knew what that witness was saying, except for Alan Jackson. So that was kind of the funny kind of group moment there as well.
Our experts who were here before you are really sort of describing a scenario where the defense is landing the first punches. Is that the way you see it as well?
Absolutely. I mean, if we could talk to the jurors, I think I would ask, what are the stories that you are hearing from the prosecution and from the defense? I would say the prosecution should be saying Karen Reed was drunk, Karen Reed drove, John O'Keefe is dead, we think she did it. And the defense is saying, look at how messy this is. She is innocent. She is set up. But we're only hearing the defense part, even though the prosecution is calling the witnesses. And they are setting this very slow timeline of what happened and setting the scene. And I know that it's important for them, for the prosecution, to describe the snow and the ice and how cold it was, because it's important to the evidence of how long the body was there and all these other things. But I almost saw a juror roll her eyes when another witness was asked about the weather report, which we talked about last night
here. Because it's established now.
It's established. It was
a blizzard.
And it was cold. And, you know, so I just don't know what this is accomplishing by rehashing evidence, facts, that have already been established.
You have to remember there are humans in the jury pool who are, you know, we get tired or you can drone on too long and people just sort of tune out.
Right. You know, people stop listening, right?
All right. Sue, thank you.
You're welcome.
An update from the Canton police audit and the contentious meeting we saw last night. That's when we come back.
We have an update now on the audit for Canton Police. It was supposed to be the first of many steps to launch an independent audit into the police department, but it actually started with a lot of arguing back and forth.
Very divisive. Remember, this meeting is the result of a town vote last November to audit Canton PD. This was the first of three meetings. The committee says it hopes to have an auditor in place by this summer.
Just a reminder, no court in session tomorrow. That doesn't mean we won't be back here at 7. There is so much still to talk about. But that's all for tonight. I'm JC Monahan.
I'm Glenn Jones. This has been Canton Confidential.